Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Every day, work is done on our behalf that keeps us safe, attends to our needs, and our convenience. We call them today first responders or essential workers. And let's face it, while we depend on these workers every day, most of us wouldn't want that job. And even if we are one of those workers in a given field, we probably wouldn't want a job in a different essential field. Most of the time, we never think about the people who do those jobs, although during the pandemic, we are thinking about them more. But there's another class of worker just as essential, but there's often a stigma attached to their work, so we think about them even less. My guest today refers to these jobs as dirty work, and he spent time with these workers who today and every day experience the same set of occupational hazards as our first responders and essential workers, but with no acknowledgement, no pat on the back for the work they do, and of course, their suffering, PTSD, shame, and moral injury. That work includes people who work in correctional facilities, meat processing plants, high-tech jobs like military drone operators, or those who are extracting minerals needed for our high-tech gadgetry in the natural resources-rich developing world. A.L. Press is an author and journalist who has written for The New Yorker and The New York Times and other publications, and his new book is titled Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. A.L. Press, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Your new book, Dirty Work, The Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. First of all, let's just define what is dirty work.
So I define it a little differently than I think most people think of that term. In kind of common usage, we use dirty work to talk about just any old unpleasant job, or maybe someone will think of, you know, hauling garbage off the streets as dirty work. But my definition is a little different, and I refer to dirty work as unpleasant and really morally compromised activities that society depends on and tacitly condones, but generally doesn't want to hear too much about. So if we think about, you know, what goes on the kill floors of the typical slaughterhouse, for example, that's something that, you know, is pretty central to our food system. But I think that even folks who eat a lot of meat don't want to look at too closely. It's that type of kind of both dependence and not wanting to see that is what I call dirty work.
You write about how this title came to you. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. You know, I've been thinking about, my whole life, I've been writing about people who are in difficult moral situations and who end up having to, you know, make choices about whether to keep their hands clean or dirty their hands. So that was sort of part of it. But then I stumbled across an essay that was published more than 50 years ago by a sociologist named Everett Hughes. And Hughes taught at the University of Chicago, was a really influential figure in his time, but is kind of forgotten today. Anyway, the essay I stumbled across was called Good People and Dirty Work. And just that title kind of jumped out at me, the sort of juxtaposition. What does he mean by good people? And what does he mean by dirty work? As it turns out, Hughes had taught after World War II in Germany. And while he was there, he talked to the folks that he'd known before the war. And most of them were what he referred to as good people. That's a little bit in the sort of air quotes, if you will. But these were not people who supported the Nazis and the horrors that went on in Nazi Germany. They were cosmopolitan professionals. They were white collar, architects and journalists and teachers. So he wanted to talk to them and find out, you know, what did they have to say about these horrible things that had happened under Adolf Hitler? And what Hughes found was that on the one hand, they told him what he expected to hear, which is, you know, they were horrified by it. As one architect told him one night, I'm ashamed about this for my people whenever I think about it. At the same time, in that same conversation, the architect goes on to say, but, you know, the Jews, they were a problem. They were a problem. They, you know, they were taking all the good jobs. They were in these filthy ghettos. And something had to be done to settle this problem. Of course, Hughes is understandably disturbed by this, and he keeps hearing this on the one hand, on the other hand thing. And that title of the essay, Good People in Dirty Work, is his sort of reflections on this. And what he ends up saying is that good people who disavowed responsibility for what, you know, who said they were ashamed, also didn't want to ask too many questions about what was happening to the Jews in the Nazi era, because at some level they saw it as a problem that needed to be taken care of. And he goes on to kind of say that this is a dynamic you will find in every society. And that's the piece of it that I kind of pull on that thread to think about, you know, what are the forms of dirty work in the United States that we countenance but don't want to hear too much about?
Well, your book looks at a variety of that work that we as a society collectively justified as needed for our safety, our security, our needs, or just our convenience. But we turn a blind eye to those doing the work. And if we were ever asked to do any of that work, we would run as quickly away from it as possible. What was the first place you examined? You know, I was thinking about sanitation workers, food providers, like in industrial food providers, criminal justice system. But what was the first place you looked and why?
The first place I looked was the mental health ward of a prison in Florida. And the reason I did that is because this is a place that serves two functions. One, okay, it's a prison, and just about every modern society has prisons or jails. There is, of course, a movement that says we should abolish the prisons. But generally speaking, prisons are pretty common in the modern world. And we think of them as places where, you know, they're through the criminal justice system, that this is the law. If someone violates the law, they go to prison. But of course, there's a problem with that. One is that we have had an era of mass incarceration. So America has built the largest prison system in the world, which is just an amazing thing. And, you know, for some communities, just a devastating thing. And not only is that prison system devastating for the communities impacted by incarceration, it's also, you know, a lot of people work in prisons and jails as a consequence of this. So that was one reason I thought of, you know, what's it like for the people who work in those facilities? But the second thing was looking specifically at a mental health ward, because as it turns out, we rely on jails and prisons to, in effect, do the dirty work of warehousing folks with mental illnesses. Jails and prisons are the largest mental health institutions in just about every state in the country at this point. So again, we are relying on a form of, you know, we're solving a problem in a sense for society. If you want to go back to what I was saying about Everett Hughes, where do all the folks with mental health problems go if we don't have public hospitals to put them in? And what we've answered as a society is the jail or the prison.
Yes, in fact, you know, we have deinstitutionalized our mental health confinement system, and the prisons serve in that function. What did you find once you examined that Florida unit?
What I found was a really, really dramatic and just vivid example of what dirty work does. And I think what it does is it puts the people doing it in very difficult situations, in moral and ethical situations that can cause them to feel implicated in what is really a system that you know, they didn't create, but they end up feeling sullied by it. So in the case of the mental health ward I looked at in Florida, you had a lot of violence and a lot of abuse. And the mental health attendants who work there, they have, on the one hand, a responsibility to care for the patients, you know, in that ward, to try to give them medication, to give them therapy, to try to stabilize them in some way. At the same time, they need to get along with security, with the guards in the institution, because the guards also provide them with security, right? So I follow a particular woman, Harriet Kriskovsky, who worked there. And Harriet is feeling the tug of these two things, because what she's seeing is that guards are mistreating her patients, skipping meals, not giving them meals, verbally accosting them. But if she says something, and at one point she does say something, she ends up putting herself at risk. You know, the guards don't open the doors for her as quickly. The guards disappear from the rec yard when she's there. And so she quickly learns that, as her supervisor indeed told her, her job is to get along with security, not to challenge. And think about that from the perspective of a mental health attendant who's watching mistreatment. You know, do you say something or do you turn a blind eye to it?
That was something that really struck me throughout the book. There's a big disconnect between oftentimes the employer's stated employee protections, the values of their organization, and reality. And that doesn't matter whether it's in a prison, whether it's on the line of a slaughterhouse, or just about all of these essences of dirty work. There's this big disconnect between the corporate or the government philosophy and practice.
Absolutely. And I want to say something about inequality, because I think that if we think about that mental health attendant, imagine if that mental health attendant were a graduate of Harvard or Yale or, you know, some really prestigious institution. They came from a family with a lot of resources and choices, and they end up working in this place that puts them in this incredibly difficult situation where they feel awful. And Harriet, by the way, in the course of doing her job, you know, suffers depression. She loses weight. She's eventually actually diagnosed with PTSD. Well, imagine if the, you know, elites of the psychiatric profession were seeing this and experiencing it directly. I have a very strong suspicion that we would, number one, be hearing about it a lot more, and two, probably be doing something about it. But the nature of dirty work, I argue in this book, is that it ends up being delegated to folks lower down the social ladder. And one of the things that happens because of that is that we don't hear about it as much. You know, no one asked Harriet, you know, what's it like at your job? What are you seeing? What she did not have the voice, the prominence, the platform. And really none of the dirty workers in my book do.
One of the things I found interesting was you were writing about finding a correctional facility in Florida. And this is one of the great facts of this explosion of corrections is that they're often put in towns that are otherwise economically depressed. The factories have closed. The traditional businesses that sustain the community have dried up. And the prison becomes the new, if you will, economic savior for that community surviving. And I think of it here in rural Oklahoma, and it's probably that way in many rural states around the country, where if you speak up about something that's happening, you're not only endangering your job and opening yourself to retaliation at the job, but you're also affecting the whole community's livelihood. And there's this great social weight put up on these folks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just to go back to the inequality theme, you touched on a side of it that really is so important and really was reflected in what I found, which is regional inequality. So just as it's not, you know, the elite folks who are graduating from the Ivy League institutions who end up getting these, you know, doing the dirty work, it's also not the elite communities, the wealthy posh suburbs, where you'll see an institution like, you know, an industrial slaughterhouse or, you know, a big prison or jail. It's not an accident that those institutions are more likely to be found in remote areas, in rural areas, in down and out areas. And you're correct. There's a kind of dependence for the region. You know, we need these jobs on the one hand. On the other hand, there's something of a stigma that comes with, you know, having a new jail or a new prison in town. And in fact, I go back and look at, you know, some of the research on why that happened. And initially, a lot of rural areas and small towns didn't want jails and prisons in their locales for the exact same reason that people in wealthy suburbs don't want them. You know, it's seen as a kind of stigmatized institution. But as the economic conditions changed, you know, farms went belly up and factories and mills closed, the calculus changed. And so that is indeed why you see the concentration in these areas.
My guest today is A.L. Press. He's an author and journalist. He's contributed to The New Yorker, The New York Times, and other publications. His latest book is titled Dirty Work: Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you follow Harriet Krakowsky through a good part of that first section of the book, but there are other folks that show up as well. And what I found was that there was one, and I'm forgetting his name now, but he only worked in the correction system for a short time and is now retired. And he says he felt like he could just feel like the job was draining him. And he was so happy that he retired and sort of got back to a normal life. And it was just, you know, you just feel for these folks in these jobs because you hear how draining it is. Harriet's had long-term effects. Many of the folks that work in corrections or in a lot of these jobs have really long-term health effects from working in
them. That's right. You know, I wanted to write about prison guards because I felt like, you know, they are, you know, not unlike other law enforcement officers. They're in a dangerous profession. They wear a badge. There's all the controversy and real challenges and life and death decisions that come with that. But there's none of the, you know, there's no thank you from society for what prison guards do. One guard, in fact, told me, you know, I think it was his brother or his cousin who was a police officer. And he said, you know, when someone dies in the line of duty, for him, it's on the news. There's a public funeral. One of my peers dies. Nobody notices. There's nothing in the paper. There's not, you know. It's a sense that you guys don't matter and you're not actually even real officers. And I should say, you know, when people read the first part of my book and are following Harriet and the mental health aides, they're going to think, oh, okay, the guards are the bad guys in this book because they're carrying out the abuses that Harriet witnesses and that she wants to talk about but feels too afraid to do. But then I kind of turn the focus to, as you mentioned, the guard you mentioned, Bill Curtis, and some other guards, and talk about the conditions they work under. And, you know, in Florida, you have a system. It's the third largest prison system in the country. But the budgets have been slashed, and the shifts are longer, and there are fewer programs and fewer resources. And as Bill Curtis, this, you know, former prison guard, told me, you know, it doesn't take long for a guard to learn that the only way you're going to control things in an environment like that is through brute force. You learn to be a little bit brutal, as he put it. And that's what he learned, and that's what a lot of the guys he knew learned. And then he said, you know, it's one thing if society is sort of, you know, okay, that's what we expect. But it's the doublespeak about it that bothered him. You know, on the one hand, we won't fund these programs. We won't really put resources into or pay guards very well, hire enough people. On the other hand, when a scandal happens and there's a beating or a death or a brutality, it's, oh, look at these terrible people who work as prison guards.
Yeah. It's interesting that whole idea of the lack of respect also applies to a high-tech dirty job that you profile, and that's military drone operators. And you speak with two, Chris yeah. Aaron and Heather Linebaugh, who worked as drone operators. Again, it's that same lack of respect. I mean, I think there's this belief that they're like playing a video game at work, but it's with real people's lives.
Yeah, in fact, when the military at one point proposed giving a Medal of Honor to you know, people in remote combat operations, like the two people you mentioned, there was a pretty negative reaction from veterans who have served in regular combat operations. And some referred to this mockingly as a Nintendo medal. Oh. And that is the kind of perception, you know, you're not real soldiers. You haven't put any skin in the game. You haven't shown the valor that, you know, the rest of us have. And yet what is true on a bigger scale is that, you know, the folks in the drone program are fighting the way we as a society have decided we want to sort of fight these, you know, in a way, these never-ending wars. You know, we don't want to do the messy, expensive ground invasions. We don't want to put more of our own soldiers at risk, which is very understandable. But the end result is that someone is sitting at those screens, and looking at the footage and deciding when a strike will happen and when it won't. And it's done in incredible secrecy and as you say, without a similar level of valor and respect from society.
I was struck by something a military person talked about. It's like, when you're actually in a war zone, you have the esprit de corps of your, fighting for your buddies, fighting for each other, and you have that camaraderie and your decompression when you go back to base. You have that sort of, I don't want to call it team spirit because that seems sort of empty, but in a way it is. And you have these drone operators, they're working a long shift, then they drive home, often living by themselves, and living with the consequences of the actions they take or don't take in a moment's notice.
That's right. And, I think that if we think about, one of the things that's really striking about the drone program is that there's been a really high level of burnout. And the military's own studies show very high levels of stress. In fact, higher levels of stress than among, regular pilots. So why is that? If they're not putting their lives at risk, if they're not seeing, their buddies gunned down, then what form does the stress take? And I think you touched on it there, that it's a very different kind of wound of war. It's the wound of, it's a psychic wound, and it's a moral wound sometimes. Where you have to think about that decision to fire a strike or not to fire a strike. Did that cost a life? Was that the right decision? The sort of folks in the kill chain making these decisions and then not being in the war zone, but actually going back to, a suburban subdivision where other people have very little awareness that these wars are going on. I think it can create a different kind of psychological stress through isolation, through just really being alone with what you've done.
And you certainly found that in the subjects you portray. I think one of them really starts to have almost a physical breakdown.
That's right. Christopher Aaron, who was an analyst in the drone program, he did indeed have his digestive system, his just very robust guy who was a high school wrestling star, really just almost couldn't get out of bed, just felt like weak and didn't really know what was going on with him. And he slowly awakened to the fact that he was actually going through a spiritual crisis. He was, that's how he thinks about it now, that he passed through this kind of dark period of reckoning with these decisions and this form of fighting that had life and death consequences. And at the end of the day, he really wasn't sure that those decisions were justified. So he really, he did manifest it in a very similar way to some soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan.
My guest today is A.L. Press. His new book is titled Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, the last section of the book, and there's also a big section on the toll of those working in slaughterhouses and especially how this has happened with COVID, where, you have people working in unsafe conditions that are even more manifestly unsafe in a pandemic. But I want to finish on the last section of the book, which looks at the energy source of today and the last 100 years, and probably the energy source of, the next 50 years or 100 years. And that has to do with battery production and oil production. And you talk with Stephen Stone and the family, his family, who was a survivor of the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig. You followed him through a congressional hearing, and you get the toll of this work. People were more concerned about the concern of waterfowl and birds that were hurt by the oil spill than the 12 people who died.
That's right. Stephen Stone was aroused about the Deepwater Horizon, the offshore rig that famously blew up and lost a lot of his fellow workers in that blast, nearly lost his own life. And then he goes to a congressional hearing, and he and his wife are sitting there, and pictures of the victims are being shown, as you just mentioned, but the pictures are not of workers. The pictures are of pelicans and dolphins. And, you know, it's not that that's not, you know, a very sad part of what happened. It certainly is. But it was striking to Stephen Stone. It was striking to his wife, who I interviewed at length, Sarah Stone, and to other people who know this industry and know this sort of sector very well, that they weren't showing pictures of the workers, even though their families were there, the spouses were there in tears. And to me, that speaks to, you know, a kind of, oh yeah, the workers, well, do we really feel sorry for folks who go and work as roustabouts in the oil industry? It's almost like an afterthought. And Stephen Stone himself said, you know, to me, you know, I think that the difference is society sees, you know, the fowl, the birds and the fish as innocent. But me and the guys on that rig, you know, we kind of maybe had it coming to us. That's how he saw it, at least.
And yet probably everybody in that hearing drove to it or flew in from their home district to come to that hearing using oil. and I think that exactly. gets into exactly. sort of a fundamental yeah. question of the book. And you refer to these workers as the invisible class.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we haven't talked much about that, but I think that whatever you think of this work, whatever you think of the different types of jobs we've talked about in the last half hour, I think it's one thing if we say as a society, okay, we're going to have this and it's part of our world. And, the folks who do it are part of our society and we see it, we know it, we accept it. But notably, all of it is hidden. Every single form of dirty work I look at is concealed from public view. And I don't think that's an accident. I think it's because, you know, as you said at the outset, if we were asked to do it ourselves, we'd hesitate. For many people would hesitate. And even just to see it would cause discomfort. And I think as a society, we do owe it to ourselves. We owe it to the people in these jobs to take a look, to have a more open conversation about this and what's happening in our name.
AL Press, we appreciate your time today. The name of the book is Dirty Work. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
AL Press is an author and journalist, a contributor to The New Yorker, The New York Times, and other publications. His latest book is titled Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.